Nina Khrushcheva is the author of Imagining Nabokov and the Wasp Khrushchev. She is a professor of international affairs at New School University and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She is also the great-granddaughter of former Soviet Union Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Her new book is In Putin's Footsteps, along with Jeffrey Taylor, the subtitle being Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. In the book, the authors travel across Russia's 11 time zones and examine how a town in each of those zones is defined by certain factors: politics, natural resources, educational institutions, society, ethnic and religious diversity, as well as strategic geographic assets, to create a portrait of Russia. They ultimately argue that these factors make Russia one of the two indispensable nations on Earth, the other one being the United States. Again, the name of the book is In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Nina Khrushcheva to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
What brought you to this idea of looking at Russia through the time zones, the 11 time zones that are a part of the country?
Well, first of all, I thought that in the U.S. there's a very simplistic coverage of Russia. It's Moscow and St. Petersburg, and mostly even just the Kremlin and Putin in it. And so we wanted to see, or wanted to show, because we know Russia is much bigger than the Kremlin, but we don't want it to show that it is much bigger than Putin and the Kremlin. So we wanted to see what it is indeed makes Putin's country. Is it just all about Putin? And then I think the size itself is fascinating. I myself is from Moscow, and as a Moscovite, it's a little bit like a New York attitude, so you don't really get out of the bounds of the big city because
right.
everything is there. Everybody wants to come to Moscow rather than the other way around, and so I just wanted to see whether it's true or not. Is there life outside of the great city, or are there all these bears and, you know, kind of the wilderness that one would imagine is outside of the capital of the country? And so we wanted to show that, in fact, Russia is diverse and interesting and wonderful. And, you know, one of the things that when we came back, we were thinking, because it is so big, it is the largest country in the world, we were thinking, well, if we were Putin, we would think we were God. And he thinks he's God. Because when you have that size and that amount of natural resources and amount of, you know, people, creativity and character, you would think that you preside over the universe. And it does explain that idea that the Russian Tsars had and the Soviet general secretaries had, is that it is a universe in itself, and you almost don't always need the outside world because everything you need is inside it.
In the travel, you basically look at how a town in each of these time zones is defined by a certain set of factors. Give us a sense of what you were looking for when you arrived and what you wanted to compare.
Well, we wanted to see, I mean, a lot of it comes, once again, sort of the comparing to Moscow, to the Kremlin. Is it all about Putin? Is it not all about Putin? And in an interesting way, a lot of it is comparing to the center, not necessarily Moscow anymore, but it's every town in all the places we went to always wants to be the center of something. That was at times even funny, because you go to the Ural Mountains, which sort of divides the European continent into the European part and the eastern part. So it's right sort of smack in the middle of Russia almost. And you go to the last city before the Ural Mountains called Perm, and they say we're the first city in Europe. So they always wanted to be something the first. So the last city in Europe, I guess. That is their identity. You go to a city which is called Samara, which was the second capital during World War II, because Moscow was a fear that Moscow would be taken over by the Nazis. So it was the town and the city of Volga. And you go there, and they claim themselves to be very important military capital. Of course, the war has been 60 years away, or sort of 70 years away, but they are still having this identity. They even have a Stalin bunker. Joseph Stalin was supposed to go there if the Nazis would take Moscow. He never did, but it's a very important identity. So it's always the center of something that we thought were so fascinating. We looked at politics in different places, and was so some places are infinitely more liberal than other places. So that is that idea that just like America, the liberal parts are kind of at the border of the country, the blue parts and the red parts are in the middle. That's actually not the case in Russia. A lot of it, the Rust Belt, the industrial is there, but there are also plenty of places in the middle that are rather liberally defined. One of them is in Siberia, Novosibirsk, which was an amazing city where winter is cold and a lot of industrial production was going on. But it is also, we thought, was the most sophisticated city of all Russia. Forget Moscow, forget St. Petersburg. So in this, things that we discovered were something that was incredibly new and, you know, you wouldn't know necessarily unless you go there. And it's not just for the American readers. I thought that, you know, hopefully this book will be translated into Russian, because we all say, even in Russia, Russia is an empire, but nobody has seen that empire. And so our job was to see what it is and to show what it is.
As we mentioned, the name of the book is In Putin's Footsteps. How much has Putin traveled the country and traveled to see these various areas and to understand the makeup of the place?
I think he was very savvy, clearly, just because he came after Boris Yeltsin in 2000. He became president in 2000, and Yeltsin was old and frail and was a little bit, had a drinking problem, apparently, by the end of his life, maybe not even by the end of his life. So he didn't, especially in his later years, he didn't travel, and Russia was deeply humiliated by this falling apart president, by the defeat in the Cold War, by the fact that the West was really treating it as a punching bag of kind of all the problems that the world ever had and has, well, still does. So when young Putin came in the first year, he traveled more than I think Yeltsin traveled throughout his whole 8 years. And he went to Siberia more than to other places because he felt, I mean, it's a very tough place. Siberia is a, you know, kind of a, also a joke, always the coldness, but there's a very tough people, but also very kind people. That toughness and understanding of hardship really make them incredibly kind and understanding of problems of other people. And so he went there, and he was young, and he was, you know, breaking bread with locals, with peasants, and they loved him. They thought it was the most amazing thing, because how close the Russian president in this very hierarchical structure of the czars and the public, the general secretaries and the public, how often do you see live president walking around? And so he really kind of got strength from that understanding of the people, he felt. And what really got us to the idea is that I heard from a journalist who was in the Putin pool early on that he even wanted to show how diverse Russia is to the Russians, and to, on the New Year's night, would fly from one part of it, the eastern part of it, all the way to the west and stop every hour on the hour in every time zone and give a speech. And of course, Russia is so big, you can't do it. You can only do it on a, you know, sort of in a magic sleigh, the right. Santa Claus, but you can't do it on an airplane. So he did travel. He did see the country. His job as a KGB operative in East Germany, which was his job in the Soviet Union, his job was to be recruited to read people. And so he's a very good at audience reading. And when he traveled around Russia, he really read what it is, their desires, their wants. They all want to see Russia as a big, great country. And he delivered on that.
One of the things that I found fascinating is, in reading, compared it to our country and what happens here, it is fascinating, because once you get further away from Washington, D.C., those ideas and the things that are in, that are at the center of the discussion start to dissolve and fade away in some ways. Their effects are there, but the conversation and the obsession seems to wane. And that's very similar here as well from what is happening in Moscow to elsewhere in Russia.
Absolutely, absolutely. You sort of, and when you go there, people are concerned with, you know, but for them, the Kremlin is far away. I mean, it is the center of their lives in many ways, because Russia does have this vertical idea, because it's also so big that in many ways, to keep it intact, you have to have that central reasoning, central idea of power that is going to deliver for you, because, you know, the world is difficult and complicated, but the Kremlin is always there. That the tower with a clock is always there to kind of provide centrality to your existence. But absolutely, I mean, they care about, you know, on the Volga region, they care about the pollution of Volga, and then the fact that they cannot really, it was used to be easy to get black caviar to every breakfast in around that area, and now you can't. And so for them, that is an issue. For people in Vladivostok on the Pacific Ocean, it's the trailer fishing that is a problem. In the middle, there's all sorts of things. And in Novosibirsk, in one of the, you know, probably the most sophisticated city that we visited, where the greatest education system, I mean, continues to scientific center of Russia altogether. For them, part of their science is ecology. I mean, they really study the pine woods and growth out there, because that was part of the scientific study way back in the Soviet era. So now, of course, the capitalist development kicked in, and all these oligarchs are buying property there and building buildings. And so for them, that is the center of it. And so this is in when you go to another Siberian place, which used to be the center of Gulag, of the Stalin detention camps in Magadan, their story is that they are the producer, the grand producer of gold. They dig for gold, and yet it's some parts of it are incredibly poor. So that is their kind of interest. Then you go to the oil country in Tumen, and that is a remarkable experience, because 400-year history of the towns there, and yet the feeling is that it's just that it's a mixture between Klondike and Las Vegas. And so all these things we wanted to show that as Kremlin-esque as Russia is in many ways, it is also its own country, and each place has its own its own identity. And I think for us was to tell a story of a city as a time zone, but also a story of a city as a character. Each city is a character.
With that said, we talk about Putin himself, and I believe you write this in the book, that Putin's control over politics and the economy and even society is secure at the moment. Do you see that diminishing in any way?
Absolutely. And, you know, we traveled in 2017. It was secure. We finished the book right after, I think, the World Cup, sort of the summer of last year, 2018, in the fall. And that's when, in fact, that began diminishing, because, and I think we also write that in the book, that the World Cup ended up being not Putin's game. Even he brought it to Russia, and kind of to show once again it wasn't more than just Moscow and St. Petersburg. It was in a variety of cities, and did very well just to show the diversity of Russia and what it can do. But ultimately, it became people's game, and I think that is something that were slight shift in understanding, is that Russians suddenly didn't need to, you know, invade anything or win anything. They were just good hosts, and that was enough to be a great country. And that kind of that idea that the Kremlin is not responsible for all their victories or defeats was something very important. And of course, there were a couple of things that the Kremlin did, which kind of cooled people off on the whole idea of the Kremlin being on their side all the time. There was a pension reform very unpopular, continues to be unpopular pension reform. And suddenly people started paying more attention to their fridge and to the sort of their economic hardship or economic difficulties and thinking about their future and their children's future versus this great victories that Putin continues to promise either in Ukraine or in Syria or against the United States or against the West or against NATO and whatnot. So I think it's shaking, and I think the next year, 2 years, he's in power, should be in power until 2024. So that is the next few years, the next 5 years would be really interesting time to observe Russia and see whether it sort of digs in Putinism or it tries to reform itself as it tried to do quite a few times in the 20th century.
And how much do you believe that is tied to what is happening in the United States?
A bit, a lot, just because, as Russia is very concerned about the United States domination and not being recognized by the United States as an important power. One of the reasons, in fact, we mentioned that in the book, when Barack Obama kind of dismissed Putin as Russia as a regional power, we wanted to see how regional it is and what it can do as a regional power. And, we now know it can do a lot and really can shake global agendas a tremendous amount, influence United States presidential elections and whatnot. So in many ways, it was Putin's actions very often as a response to what the United States does. And certainly when he feels that there's a lot of respect and recognition, he's certainly going to show that he deserves both. He shows what Russia can do. So a lot of Russian actions, and one of the things we also write in the book, that all Russians' definition of itself, even if it is a universe, is a separate universe, is what the West does or does not. It is every time you go into a city, there is some Western comparison. I mean, I mentioned Kuybyshev, that city of Samara, where the second, when World War II, second capital, there it's a very long Volga embankment, very well done. And they say, well, it's the longest embankment of a river in Europe. But then the next sentence is, but we are not Europe. So, it's sort of that un-West understanding. So Putin's actions, Russian actions, are very often defined by the United States attitude. And I think withdrawing from the variety of agreements that the Trump administration is now doing, in fact, can feed Putin's strengths rather than undo it, because he once again can start claiming or can claim that we need those military or build up adventurism, build up force, military force in Russia, because the West is out to get us. So we have to be in Syria, we have to be in Venezuela, we have to be in other places. So I am kind of hoping and looking for better Russia policy, which doesn't seem to, most American administrations really don't have.
The name of the book is In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Nina Khrushcheva, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, In Putin's Footsteps, published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.